Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. President-elect Joe Biden says it's going to be hard, but he's confident he can work with Republicans in the Senate to get things done. How much he can get done depends partly on whether Democrats win two runoff elections in Georgia next month for the U.S. Senate. Former President Obama campaigns for Democrats today. President Trump holds a rally there tomorrow.
And last night on CNN, Joe Biden said he supports a $908 billion compromise plan that was floated in Congress this week to help people, businesses, and communities struggling during the pandemic. The bill would also help pay for the distribution of a vaccine.
We're going to need a lot more. It's going to cost literally billions of dollars to get this done. We could keep schools open. We could keep businesses open. But you have to be able to get the vaccine distributed.
It's time for our Friday Politics Roundtable. Scott Wong is senior staff writer at The Hill. Hi, Scott.
Good to be with you.
And Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for NBC News. Sahil, welcome.
Great to join you.
Scott, why don't we start with you? This morning, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said why she's supporting a smaller bipartisan coronavirus relief bill now, after months of holding out for twice as much money.
President-elect Biden has said that this package would be just, at best, just a start. And that's how we see it as well. It's less money, but over a shorter period of time, and we need to do it to save lives and livelihood with the hope that much more help is on the way.
Scott, what do you think? This is a change of position from Nancy Pelosi. Did the logjam on this relief bill finally break?
Well, it certainly looks that way. I mean, we had an unexpected breakthrough this week with this bipartisan, bicameral group of lawmakers unveiling this $900 billion framework. It has gotten a warm reception from Pelosi and the Democratic leaders, not so much from Mitch McConnell and the Republican leadership on the other side of the Capitol. But I think what possibly could facilitate this breakthrough is these Republican senators like Mitt Romney and Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski. All of them have taken part of these discussions and negotiations and are pushing their leadership to come to the negotiating table and strike a deal, especially as we've seen the numbers just get worse and worse. You know, we're now at roughly 3,000 people, Americans, dying every day from COVID. The cases are skyrocketing, and the unemployment situation is not getting any better. And so a number of lawmakers, especially these centrist lawmakers, the deal makers, are really feeling the urgency to get something done right now for so many people out there who are suffering.
Well, speaking of the Senate, Sahil, you spoke with Senator Josh Hawley, who told you that his vote is no unless the bill includes another round of $1,200 direct payments. Interesting. What does that tell you coming from a pretty conservative Republican?
It is an interesting response from Senator Hawley, who is widely viewed to have bigger ambitions than the Senate. He's kind of coming against this bipartisan package from both the left and the right. From the left, he says he wants the direct payments of $1,200 per person, or I should say up to $1,200 per person. It was in the CARES Act. It was very popular. He said he'd like to see that in there. Of course, the reason that isn't in there is that conservatives have complained about the price tag ballooning too much if those checks are in there. He also told me yesterday that he opposes additional aid to state and local governments, which is a common position among Republicans. One of two major hurdles to getting a deal done here. The other is liability protections that Senator McConnell has described as a priority for businesses and organizations from COVID-related lawsuits.
Scott, I have a question about something that Joe Biden said. He says he's confident that he can work closely with a divided Congress, but that it's not going to be easy. And I know you spoke with the House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy. Did he give you any indication that Republicans are willing to work with the Biden administration?
Well, what McCarthy told me yesterday was that he has a good relationship with the president-elect, that he said that when Biden was vice president, he would frequently have breakfast with them and that those were always very pleasant interactions. But there was no indication that they are prepared to work with the incoming president. You know, part of McCarthy's job in the minority of the House minority is messaging. And so you can be sure, based on what we've seen in the past, that they are going to be relentlessly attacking the president-elect, especially because McCarthy feels that he's really on the cusp of taking back the majority in 2 years. They're only a handful of seats away from flipping the House of Representatives. History has shown that the party in power in the White House frequently loses seats in the House. And so McCarthy really feels like he's on the cusp of not only the House majority, but the speakership itself. And so he doesn't have a real political incentive to work closely with President-elect Biden.
Sahil, I wonder if you can comment on what Joe Biden said in terms of how he's going to face this enormous issue of the coronavirus pandemic right from the start. He's urging Americans to wear a mask for 100 days to bring down coronavirus rates while a vaccine is rolled out. What does this tell you about the strategy that he has to this number one issue facing him?
Well, this has been a central component. It was a central component of Joe Biden's campaign message in 2020. Maybe the single biggest reason that he is the president-elect and that Donald Trump has been defeated, because Trump was just widely seen to not be taking this deadly pandemic seriously. Biden certainly presented himself as someone who was. He's talked about wanting the public to wear masks for 100 days. He has said he's going to keep Dr. Anthony Fauci on staff at the White House as the nation's top infectious disease expert. His future was in doubt if President Trump had won a second term. He is also assembling a team that's going to focus throughout the administration on tackling the coronavirus. And look, he's going to be judged on this because he made this promise. He campaigned as a president, as a potential president who's going to get this under control. And now he's got a daunting challenge ahead of him to try to do that as cases are surging. The death toll is climbing, and he is likely at this moment to face a divided Congress in the sense that he'll have to work with Republicans to get aid packages through next year. So I think what Congress is working on now is being described by Speaker Pelosi and others as a bridge to the Biden administration. It would get through the first few months of next year, and then it's going to be back to the drawing board, figuring out distributing the vaccine and figuring out what more needs to be done in terms of economic stimulus.
Sahil, I do want to follow up with you for just a moment on the masks here. The science is clear. Masks work. We know they have also become so politicized. I mean, do you think that Biden will run into any politics here? Will it hurt him at all to come out with this 100 days of mask wearing, do you think?
I don't think it'll hurt him because he's been very public with this for months. Most Americans support wearing masks, and those who don't probably didn't vote for him to begin with and probably aren't going to come around to him. So, yes, of course, he's going to face politics. Of course, he's going to face protests. The fact that so many conservative voters were active against mask wearing under President Trump suggests that if a Democrat is in the White House, you will probably see them crank up the volume even louder. But again, these are figures who we know oppose Biden and who he's probably not going to win over. And he probably he can, you know, garner support from a majority of the country without winning anti-mask wearers.
Yeah, you got to wonder if people who believe masks should be in place are probably wearing them anyways. This week, Attorney General William Barr said that the Justice Department has found no evidence of widespread fraud in last month's election that would overturn the results. Yesterday, when President Trump was asked if he still had confidence in Barr, this is what he said.
Ask me that in a number of weeks from now. They should be looking at all of this fraud. This is not civil.
Scott Wong, is Barr going to be fired? And does it really matter with just 40-something days left in Trump's term?
Right. If Trump did make that move, it would be purely symbolic because both of them will be out of power in a number of weeks. But I think Trump is trying to send a message to the Republican Party, and specifically Republicans that are looking to run for president in 2024, that you know, look, if you cross me, if you don't stay in line, if you, you know, if you contradict me in any way, as we've seen during the past 4 years of his administration, that he will take retribution out on you. And so he is sending a clear message with this threat against his normally very loyal attorney general, sending the message out to the rest of the Republican Party that even though he will be leaving office in a number of weeks, he still has a firm grasp on this Republican Party.
Very briefly, Sahil, we only have about 30 seconds left. President Trump says that he may run again in 2024. Does that freeze out other Republicans, or has the party and is the party moving beyond him?
The party is not moving beyond him. I think that'll certainly freeze out some other Republicans. It's probable that he would begin as the immediate front runner if he were to run again in 2024. And just to return to the beginning, the first topic we had, when I spoke to Senator Hawley yesterday, he said he would support President Trump if he were to run in 2024 and that he would not run in 2024. He said it would be almost certain that Trump wins the nomination again. So that's someone who is rumored to be considering it, telling you he'll support Trump. I think that's a significant signal.
Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for NBC, Scott Wong at The Hill. Thank you.
I promise you that when it's then made for people who are less at risk, I will be taking it, and you know, I may end up taking it on TV or having it filmed just so that people know that I trust this science.
That's former President Barack Obama on the SiriusXM radio network last night, saying he'd be willing to take a coronavirus vaccine on camera when it becomes available. Obama was talking specifically to the African-American community that has been disproportionately hit hard by the virus, but where skepticism about the vaccine remains high. Side Effects Public Media's Carter Barrett reports.
Carmel, Indiana resident Mia McLendon says she signed up to participate in AstraZeneca's COVID vaccine trial to show others she believes it's safe. Still, as a Black woman, she says she's experienced skepticism firsthand.
Definitely. I have close friends. Even my husband is very reluctant about taking a shot.
A recent Gallup poll found that less than half of non-white American adults would be willing to receive a COVID vaccine, compared to 61% of white adults. That's why the Indiana State Department of Health's plan for vaccine distribution includes messaging to communities of color. The strategy is being developed with partners like the Indiana Minority Health Coalition. Its president, Carl Ellison, says convincing some members of the Black community to get vaccinated will be an uphill battle and require a multi-year commitment from state officials.
So you can't say, we'll do an awareness campaign for each phase of the rollout and we'll do it in 6 weeks or whatever. That's like, why bother? You know, because what you're trying to change is a fundamentally baked-in response to racism in the health delivery system, period.
Some experts have ideas for building trust and bridging the access gap, like mobile vaccination sites that can travel to churches and grocery stores and places like the Jane Pauley Community Health Center in Indianapolis. Dr. Sherry Lynn McCombe is chief medical director there, and she's been talking with Indiana officials about vaccine distribution.
What concerns me is not their efforts. What concerns me is that we have in this country a history that is not conducive to minorities participating in something that would save their life.
The most infamous example, Tuskegee, that government-led medical study enrolled Black men with syphilis who were told they would get treatment. Instead, researchers secretly withheld that treatment, and many of these men died. The study ended in the early 1970s, well within memory for many.
No amount of media messaging can erase the past unless your media messaging and public messaging is specific to acknowledging what has happened in the past and how this is different.
Local hospitals in the city of Indianapolis have formally acknowledged racism as a public health issue. The state of Indiana has not. While accounting for 13% of the U.S. population, Black Americans make up nearly 20% of COVID deaths.
It's not just, oh, these people just happen to all get COVID. And it's not, oh, these people are just living recklessly. You know, you can tie very specific government policy, historical action and inaction that have created circumstances where these populations of people are more vulnerable.
That's Yolanda Wilson, a bioethicist and National Humanities Center fellow. Wilson says skepticism over vaccines in the Black community is justified. And to overcome the past, she says America needs to confront the intersection of health, discrimination, and trust head on. For Here and Now, I'm Carter Barrett.
In June of 1991, Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines erupted. It was one of the most catastrophic volcanic events of the century. Hot ash shot 22 miles into the sky.
People in surrounding villages ran for their lives. And within minutes, falling ash turned day into night.
The ash spewed 20 million tons of sulfur dioxide into the stratosphere. That gas formed a kind of shield around the Earth. It reflected sunlight back into space and led the Earth to cool for 2 years. The temperature dipped a half degree Celsius, a big drop. Scientists have wondered if we could cool the Earth like that on purpose to reduce the effects of climate change. Harvard Applied Physics professor David Keith explains the controversial concept known as solar geoengineering.
Solar geoengineering is the idea that humans might deliberately alter the climate. They would reflect away a little bit of sunlight, just the way a very thin cloud reflects away a little bit of sunlight, to offset some of the warming that comes from the slow buildup of carbon dioxide from our industrial activity.
For a long time, research into solar geoengineering was taboo, the stuff of sci-fi movies. It's a powerful technology with the potential to disrupt the atmosphere, the climate, and people's health. But with climate change bearing down on us, some researchers are venturing into the science. David Keith and Harvard atmospheric chemistry professor Frank Koich are planning a first-of-its-kind field experiment to help scientists understand solar geoengineering's efficacy and risks. They plan to release an aerosol, less than 2 kilograms of calcium carbonate, into a tiny portion of the stratosphere to see how it behaves. For now, Keith and Koich are working at a laboratory at Harvard. They have a metal tube about a yard long that's acting as a mini stratosphere. That's the second layer of the atmosphere. They're conducting experiments inside the tube, similar to the one they want to carry out high above the Earth.
So we go to stratospheric temperatures, we go to stratospheric pressures in there, we put in the aerosol that we want to understand the reactivity of, and then we look at these reactions in here.
That aerosol, the calcium carbonate, is the same compound that's in limestone and shells. It is not in the stratosphere, but one day humans could spray enough of it there to reflect away the sun. In this experiment, though, the Harvard scientists want to measure how the compound interacts with gases in the stratosphere. That could help determine if it would further damage the ozone layer. David Keith says their plan is to launch a scientific balloon.
The balloon is about a few stories in diameter, and these are the same as other stratospheric balloons that have been used for science for a long time.
It would rise 12 miles high, twice as high as a passenger plane flies. Koich says the balloon would have a metal gondola hanging from it with propellers.
That gondola has a mechanism that allows you to inject particles into the stratosphere. So as you're moving along, you make a plume that is about a few kilometers in length. Then you would try to turn the balloon around and sample back going through this plume, comparing how the air outside of the plume is different from the air and the aerosol in the plume.
Their project is called SCOPEX, for Stratospheric Controlled Perturbation Experiment. The Harvard scientists insist this is not solar geoengineering. They say it's too modest to affect the climate and that it's safe. Others disagree.
As soon as you start putting particles into the stratosphere, aren't you intervening with climate?
That's Daniel Sitso, who's a professor of atmospheric and planetary sciences at Purdue University. Sitso calls the SCOPEX project climate intervention and says messing with the climate is dangerous.
Even though you're saying I'm doing it as an experiment, the result is exactly the same. It might be a smaller scale, but I would argue that if you're putting enough material there that you're going to be looking at the properties of that material and trying to tell what effect they have, that what you're doing is an experiment on climate intervention.
Sitso says full-scale climate intervention, or solar geoengineering, would disrupt the formation of clouds, further hurt the ozone layer, and do nothing to reduce carbon in the atmosphere.
I'm not willing to sign up for, you know, something that's a solution to the temperature problem that's going to cause more skin cancer, that's going to allow for continued acidification of the oceans, or that's going to cause regional droughts or precipitation. I'm just not personally comfortable with that. especially when we have another path in climate, which is the reduction of these greenhouse gases that we know are the underlying cause.
The three scientists agree on that point, that the real solution is to cut back on fossil fuels. They're concerned people will view solar geoengineering as an easy out. Harvard's Frank Koich says that's the moral hazard of the science.
This experiment can be misinterpreted as that there is a technical remedy that gets us off the hook, where it should be clear that even in the best-case scenario, the solar geoengineering in the stratosphere, it doesn't address the causes of climate change. It's addressing a symptom.
David Keith is concerned about the energy industry shirking its responsibility to combat global warming.
I'm talking about big oil, big fossil fuel companies, that they will claim that because of this technofix, there's no need to cut emissions. That's not true. Nothing about solar geoengineering changes the fact that if you want a stable climate, you eventually have to cut emissions to zero.
So then what is the role for solar geoengineering? What is your expectation?
The promise of solar geoengineering is that the combination of emissions cuts and solar geoengineering could actually be significantly safer, have lower human and environmental risks, less sea level rise, less people dying from heat stroke, less change in the high Arctic glaciers than would a world with just emissions cuts. So there's really a prize here, a huge human and environmental benefit.
But we need to understand the consequences, good and bad, according to Keith, before a world leader makes a rash move.
Some government, faced by maybe a huge killing heat wave, may make decisions to actually move towards deploying these technologies within the next decades, whatever research we do. We are more likely to make a reasoned decision as a species, as humanity, about this if we get it out in the open, warts and all.
There is no national or international governing structure for solar geoengineering. Harvard has formed an independent committee to review the SCOPEX experiment, including its safety and environmental impact. Meanwhile, the coronavirus pandemic kept David Keith and Frank Koich out of their lab for a few months. They're back now, working toward the day they can get the go-ahead to launch their big balloon.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. A resilient city and region relies on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve Greater Boston's most serious problems. From the hardships of COVID to the fight for racial equity and other important issues that affect the lives of everyone in our community. Learn how you can help build a Greater Boston that works for everyone by partnering with the Boston Foundation at tbf.org/partner.
Mink farms in four states are reporting outbreaks of the coronavirus among the weasel-like animals. It's just a fraction of the U.S. mink fur industry. But the impact could be big if the situation here goes the way of Denmark, where millions of COVID-infected mink had to be culled. In Wisconsin, two farms are under quarantine. Chuck Quernbach from member station WUWM reports.
Large department stores have been ending sales of natural fur amid years of international concerns raised by animal activists. But you can still find a few furriers. One of the last in Milwaukee is Rodney Ugent, whose family's been in the business for 98 years. During a tour of his showroom, Ugent points to mink coats, purses, and
mink headbands. Here it is in purple, fuchsia, blue.
Ugent says besides being soft and lightweight, one of the enduring appeals of mink is that it can be dyed.
The people today don't want the mink that their mother or grandmother bought. They're buying colors.
Ugent says he's following what's happening here and in Europe, where some mink have become infected with a strain of the coronavirus known as SARS-CoV-2, which in humans causes the disease COVID-19. The outbreak includes two of the 19 mink farms in Wisconsin. The two have been under quarantine for weeks as testing of pelts and remaining animals continues. A total of about 5,000 mink have died at the locations. Wisconsin State veterinarian Darlene Conkle says it appears humans working at the two farms infected the animals early this fall.
It's true with any situation when you're talking about viruses or bacteria. You know, all it takes is one opportunity sometimes when that pathogen can make it into the mink farm.
Conkle says there's not enough evidence of risk at the Wisconsin farms to order a mass culling of the mink. A veterinarian who works for the trade group, Fur Commission USA, agrees. Dr. John Easley says the virus doesn't seem to hurt all of the animals.
Just like it seems like in the human population, there's a subpopulation that seems to be most susceptible to the virus. The rest of the animals ward that off very quickly.
Plus, Easley says the mink industry is working with companies on a potential vaccine for the animals. The SARS-CoV-2 infections in mink have some people worried about the virus affecting other species. But Dr. Keith Polson, who directs the Veterinary Diagnostics Lab at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, says mink, which are related to ferrets, have a lung structure that makes them more vulnerable.
Those are the really highly susceptible animals have those receptors that really grab onto that virus and allow it to propagate. We kind of have this kind of continuum of other species that we know can be infected and may propagate and shed, like cats. It's still not considered. They don't do it at the same level as people and mink and ferret.
And as for animal-to-human transmission of the virus, state and federal health agencies continue to say the risk is very low, but not zero. Suzanne Gibbons-Bergener is an infectious diseases epidemiologist with the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. She says officials keep urging farm workers near animals to take precautions. She also says agencies continue to monitor whether the virus can survive in the pelts of mink that are harvested this year.
We want to assure people that we are not releasing those products until we know that they do not pose a risk.
For Here and Now, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
Before the pandemic, many of us worked in open office buildings, with most people sitting in one big room together. Well, now many of those workers are at home, giving architects new ideas about the open office concept in the post-COVID era. Joshua McNichols from member station KUOW has more from Seattle.
Architect Andrea Veneco says in college, many people discover a new kind of freedom. There's no parents to boss you around, so you get to manage your own time.
When you're in college, you know, you go to the library and study for 2 hours, and then you know you need to go to the cafe to sort of like have some energy, and then you go back to your apartment. You sort of decide when you're going to work where and what kind of environment you need. So you're very self-aware in terms of your own productivity.
And then after college, you get a job in an office, and someone sits you down and tells you,
you're going to sit right here for 8 hours, and you're going to be productive.
And what happens as you grind through workday after workday under the unyielding fluorescent lights of your open office is you forget. You forget how to control your environment. You forget how to take walks when you need to, how to change your location to keep your energy up. You just learn to grind it out. Veneco and her colleague Ryan Mullenix, who both work at the architecture firm NBBJ, call this phenomenon learned helplessness.
I think what's fascinating about learned helplessness is, at its essence, it's essentially the loss of control, which is the pure definition of stress. When I can't control something, I'm stressed. And so we had created these environments where you walk in and you have no control over anything. I don't get to control where I sit. I don't get to control the light. I don't get to control the acoustics. I don't get to control who I sit next to, for the most part.
It's not that open offices are always bad. They've got great transparency, and there's an ease of communication across cubicles, and that makes it easy to collaborate in teams. Sometimes that's what we need. After all, we're social animals. It's the ubiquity of open offices that's oppressive. They're everywhere, and unless you're a manager with your own private office, you can't escape them. Until COVID sent us all home. And now, these architects say that many people working from home are relearning how to take control of their own environment.
As you move through your day, you probably at home do move around more.
Maybe it's as simple as moving from a table to a comfortable chair, or closing a bedroom door to cut down on interruptions from kids, or opening a window, or taking a walk.
At home, you know what it is that you need to do, and you just go do it.
And when workers come back to the office after the pandemic, these architects say workers will expect to retain some of the habits they've developed while working from home. Veneco says lots of companies are asking them for help now, redesigning their offices. Their clients are calling from all over the world. but it doesn't take an architect to make some small changes. It can be as simple as taking out a couple of desks and turning that area into a different kind of space, maybe a darker, quiet space with lower ceilings and soft surfaces, a good space for reading.
Moving away from the endless consistency that we see in offices.
In the office of the future, Veneco says maybe you don't have an assigned desk. Maybe when you come into the office, you choose from a variety of different environments and move from one to another over the course of your day. Mullenix says COVID taught us to start trusting employees with these decisions.
For example, it's not about being able to work at home on a Monday or a Friday. It's actually giving them permission to communicate when they're going to work where and how and why. And then accepting that, trusting that.
And he says, now we're showing the world we can be productive, even when we're not tethered to our desks. For Here and Now, I'm Joshua McNichols in Seattle.
In the early days of the pandemic, you probably noticed signs in stores asking you to pay with exact change because of a national coin shortage. The Federal Reserve even formed a coin task force to address the problem. But it's December, and those signs in the stores are still up. So what's going on, and what does it mean for those of us who still kind of like having nickels, quarters, and dimes rattling around in our pockets? Jay Zagorski is a professor at Boston University's Questrom School of Business. Jay, welcome.
Nice to be here, Peter.
So first of all, could you solve this mystery for me? I don't fully understand why a pandemic led to a coin shortage.
There's a couple of reasons. First, there's about $48 billion worth of coins that are circulating through society at any given point in time. And during the pandemic, new coins basically stopped because the mint shut down because they, like many other manufacturing places, were very concerned about the pandemic's impact on their workforce. So new coin production completely stopped. Banks were very worried, so they shut their lobbies. People could get access to the ATMs, but walking into a lobby with, say, a bag full of coins to be deposited didn't happen. Supermarkets is another place where coins get put back into society. A lot of people use things like Coinstar machines. If you're going to a supermarket in the middle of the pandemic, you didn't want to stop at a Coinstar machine and pour in all your quarters, nickels, and dimes. So for a whole bunch of reasons, people still wanted to use coins, but very few coins were being recirculated through society.
And what kind of problems did that cause for businesses?
So it caused a lot of problems because when you showed up and actually paid cash and were supposed to get change back, many businesses didn't have change to give you. And this is a big problem because about 6-7% of society is unbanked. Unbanked means they don't have credit cards. They don't have debit cards. They use cash.
So what has happened in the last few months? I see that the U.S. Mint has been working overtime since the spring, and it's now on track to mint the most coins it has in 20 years. But I, like I said, I still go to the store and I see those signs. It hasn't gone away, has it?
The Mint is definitely working overtime. For example, in 2019, it produced 1.6 billion quarters, which is quite a few. And right now, we still have a month left to go, and they're up to 2.7 billion quarters of what they've produced. And that was with the shutdown at the beginning of the COVID pandemic.
Look, I know you think a lot about the future of currency, and there's already been a push before the pandemic to get rid of the poor little penny. So has this coin crisis, if you could call it that, revealed anything about where we're headed as a society?
So retailers, banks, high-tech companies, government, they're all pushing us to go towards a more cashless society. Retailers really enjoy a cashless society because when people pay with cash, they have to count those coins. They have to get them back to the bank. It's expensive for them. Banks love a cashless society because they make money on loans. And the more often you use a credit card, the more often banks get a cut of what you spend. Amazon's really big. If you don't have a credit card, how do you order something on Amazon?
You can't see me, but I'm scratching my head. No, I have no idea.
So you could go to a supermarket and buy an Amazon gift card, pay the supermarket cash. And let's say it's a $50 gift card. And then you go to Amazon, you put the $50 gift card in so you can spend up to $50. But what if you're going to purchase something like $42? That means Amazon's holding on to $8 until you decide to buy something else. And for some of the poor people in society, you know, losing $8 here, you know, $5 there, that can be the difference between having dinner or not having dinner at night.
So how realistic is this move to a cashless society? Do you think we're on our way there, or will what you just referenced be something that holds us back because we can't be a cashless society because too many people would lose out?
We're going towards a cashless society. No matter how often I speak on the radio and say, you know, it's okay, if we slow down a little bit, because there's a whole bunch of problems when we go to a purely cashless society. Let me be very clear, Peter. I use credit cards, but I don't use credit cards for everything.
Well, I wonder if another issue is that so many Americans are dealing with mountains of debt. The average American is about $90,000 in the hole, according to Experian. Don't people tend to spend more when they use digital currencies or credit cards instead of cash?
One of the problems we're going to as a cashless society is it separates the purchase from actually paying. It reduces the pain point. When you have to pull a wad of bills out, there's a moment of pain. However, if you just slap down a credit card, you're going to pay maybe next month or months later if you decide not to pay off your credit card bill in full. And this is the exact same reason why casinos use chips instead of cash, because it doesn't feel like it's real anymore. And when it doesn't feel real, you increase your spending. So by moving to a cashless society, what happens is we end up with increased spending and reduction in savings.
Do you think the pandemic has pushed us this direction even further?
I do. There's a lot of people who were using cash and are now concerned that maybe they could get germs from cash, because lots of people, lots of different hands touch cash and touch coins. So because people think it's cleaner, because they've only touched their credit cards, they've only touched their debit cards, lots of people don't want to be using cash during the pandemic.
Jay Zagorski, professor at Boston University's Questrom School of Business. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The cable network Showtime premieres a new drama starring Bryan Cranston this Sunday. It's called Your Honor. Cranston plays a respected judge in New Orleans who finds out that the person he loves most in the world has been implicated in a death, and the person who died was the son of a crime boss. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us to talk about Your Honor and more. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
So Bryan Cranston, who's best known for his role in Breaking Bad, plays a very different kind of anti-hero in Your Honor. What's he like in this role as a judge?
Bryan Cranston seems to be playing a good man. He seems to be a fair judge, and he seems to be a good dad to a son. He lost his wife. His son lost their mother. His son gets in a car accident because he was visiting, I guess, the site where she died, and got distracted and wound up running over someone on a motorcycle, and it turned out to be the son of the biggest crime boss in the city. And initially, Bryan Cranston's character tries to get his son to turn himself in, but when he goes to turn him in, he realizes who this person was who got killed, and realized his son would be killed in prison. And he tries to convince his son that what they really have to do is cover up the crime. And so we have a clip where Cranston's character is talking to his son. Let's check it out.
Don't tell anyone. Not ever. I can do this. I can keep you safe if no one ever hears about it. You understand? Adam, this is the rest of our lives.
You know, just hearing Bryan Cranston there, regardless of the plot, which sounds pretty interesting, it sounds like this might be worth watching just for Cranston's performance.
It might be. I mean, I will say, you know, Breaking Bad was interesting because it was about this sort of complex idea that a guy who might seem to be placid and kind of a good person, like once you remove all the things about society that compel that person to be a nice guy and to be functional and to care about people, what kind of person are you left with? Now, Your Honor is more the story of a guy who's essentially good, who's getting pushed into doing all of these things that are contrary to all of his ethics. He has to break all of his rules in order to protect this person. And to me, in a weird way, that's a less compelling journey. I wasn't surprised enough by this, but I love Bryan Cranston as an actor. Michael Stuhlbarg plays the crime boss, who's also a wonderful actor. He played a crime boss in Boardwalk Empire, people will remember. So I have high hopes for the show, but what I've seen of it so far, I was less than impressed, I'll be honest.
We want to ask you also about Hillbilly Elegy. This came out last month on Netflix, based on the 2016 best-selling memoir of the same name. Eric, critics were not so impressed. Audiences, though, liked it. I wonder where you as a critic came down on it.
Sure. So I have to say I agree with a lot of the critics' assessments of this film. So Hillbilly Elegy is basically the story of the author's journey. He has poor roots in his family. His mother is addicted to drugs. And he's in this Ivy League school, about to graduate, trying to get some important internships or first jobs. And his mother relapses and he has to go back to his old home and try to get her sorted out. The criticism of the book is that it simplified that struggle and that it made it seem as if, you know, surviving drug addiction and surviving a family legacy of violence is just a matter of making a choice. And I think, unfortunately, the movie just kind of amplified and echoed a lot of those same troubling criticisms of the book. But it's a really well-made movie. You know, Ron Howard is technically a great director. And of course, Glenn Close and Amy Adams deliver great performances, which I think, you know, the audiences are really responding to. As a matter of fact, there's this a really interesting scene where Bev, Amy Adams' character, is driving her son and they get into an argument. And out of spite, she threatens to drive the car off the road and kill both of them. So let's listen to that.
You have no clue. I was second in my whole class out of 400 people. Did you know that? I could have done whatever I wanted, but I didn't have somebody taking me to the library and telling me I could go to college and gonna help me pay for it. I could crash.
Oh.
I could crash this car and I could kill us.
Stop.
Then you would know how lucky you are.
Stop the car, please.
And so that's emblematic of a lot of the conflicts in the film where they're highly emotional. Critics come to this film and sort of perceive that the story is kind of superficial and that Ron Howard is doing a lot of gimmicky things to sort of make the audience feel one way or another as you move through the story. You know, this is a movie that's designed to garner Oscar nominations. You know, there are powerful, emotive performances, and people are already wondering, is Amy Adams going to be nominated for an Oscar? And so I think critics sometimes can bring a lot of knowledge about the industry and a lot of knowledge about why that movie exists that the average viewer doesn't necessarily know. And I'm not saying that they need to know that stuff, but I am saying that it does sometimes affect how you view a film when you finally see it, and you can sense that disappointment when you read a lot of the reviews.
Well, we always appreciate your reviews and your take. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans talking about Hillbilly Elegy on Netflix and the Showtime drama called Your Honor with Bryan Cranston that premieres this Sunday. Thanks a lot, Eric.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.